Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
What sanctions can do and what they can't. A look at what's happening inside Syria on the broadcast today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Tuesday, the 14th of February. Good to have you with us. Foreign ministers from the Arab League met today in Cairo to try once again to stop the government crackdown in Syria. The League said it's ready to give President Bashar al-Assad's opponents what it called all kinds of political and material support. If that sounds like a gesture born largely out of frustration, probably is. A week ago, China and Russia vetoed a UN resolution along the same lines. Syria is by far the longest-running set of protests in the Middle East, going on a year now, with no clear end in sight. Joshua Landis runs the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Josh, thanks for being with us.
It's a pleasure.
There is more talk every day of what to do about Syria. Remind us what's already been done. There are sanctions in place, right?
There are heavy sanctions in place. The United States had sanctions on Syria for three decades, but Europe joined in sanctions. And Europe provides almost 50% of trade with Syria through the EU. And Europe stopped all energy imports and exports. Companies like Shell withdrew. The Commercial Bank of Syria has been sanctioned. That means no letters of credit can be issued by the commercial banks or honored in the international community. So there is a lot being done. The currency of Syria has collapsed by 50%. It went from 47 pounds to a dollar to 72, 73.
Yeah.
So Syrians have lost half their purchasing power.
So, I mean, the Syrian economy before any of this started was not doing fabulously well. I imagine now that everything from the means of production to large industrial operations must be nearly crippled.
They are. You know, the tourist industry completely shut down. Most hotels shuttered. Now businesses are laying off. Nobody is buying. Economic activity, we believe, has fallen by about 50%. So everything is groaning under this rapid shutdown. People are not repaying their debts. I talked to one leading Syrian lawyer. He said in the last 8 months, he's done no real business deals. Everything is about closing businesses, foreign businesses trying to get out of Syria, liquidate, and giving severance payments to all their Syrian employees. And so that's what's going on in Syria. People are trying to get out of the market, and the Syrian economy is rapidly declining.
You talk to people in Syria, I would imagine, regularly, right?
Yes, I do.
What do they tell you? What's it like?
Oh, they're very frightened. My in-laws, who they can't find fuel oil. Their life savings is wasting away, and they see greater and greater violence. So they don't know what's coming. My brother-in-law, who runs a little shop, he's a Drexe shop of 60 seamstresses making clothes for Prise Unique in France. They can't get banking. Because the banking system has been gummed up with sanctions, they can't make payments and write checks back and forth between France. He has to do it all in his own personal name because that hasn't been sanctioned yet. But they're waiting for more sanctions, and they're worried that they're going to have to lay off all of their workers and that they'll close up shop.
Joshua Landis is the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. His blog that he writes is called Syria Comment. Josh, thanks a lot.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Kind of makes Wall Street seem really far away, but traders did make it back to break even today after being down all day. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The headline economic number of the day is 0.4%. That's how much retail sales bumped up last month. Commerce Department says we spent more on electronics and garden supplies in particular. Also, gas. We're paying more at the pump for a whole lot of reasons, most of which we can do nothing about. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Ganzer has that story.
The Energy Department says the average price for a gallon of regular gas is now $3.52. We're used to seeing prices go up during the busy summer driving season. But now, Tom Klosa is chief oil analyst at the Oil Price Information Service. He says prices are edging up about a month earlier than usual.
We always have a little bit of a violent spring in terms of gasoline prices. This year, they'll be a little bit more violent than normal.
Some of the volatile pricing stems from fears of violence in the Mideast. Iran is threatening to close the Straits of Hormuz. Ben Montalbano is an oil industry analyst at the Energy Policy Research Foundation. He says that would choke off oil supplies.
Most Saudi exports, most Iraqi exports, Iranian exports, Kuwaiti exports, those would essentially all be halted.
And oil prices would hit the stratosphere. That's gotten Wall Street's attention. Speculators are hoarding gas, driving up the price in the process, betting they can sell their gas stashes and make a killing when prices go up. Oil analyst Stephen Shork edits the Shork Report.
Speculators own approximately 90 million barrels of gasoline. Speculators have never owned this much gasoline.
But there are other things at play. Global demand for oil is up somewhat, and some East Coast refineries are closing, meaning more of the region's gas has to be imported. Yep, all these things are out of our control. Except, of course, we could always drive less. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Also in Washington today, financial regulators began the unenviable task of reading through more than 170,000 words of public comments about a tiny slice of the Dodd-Frank reform bill, known as the Volcker Rule. It aims to limit the risk of another financial meltdown by preventing banks from making bets with their own money, proprietary trading, as they like to say on the street. Our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore makes it make sense.
To start to understand the Volcker Rule, think of rugs. A rug merchant buys rugs, and he sells some of them to you. So think of stocks and bonds as the rugs and banks as the rug dealers.
If some people say I'm a very good rug trader and I can buy and sell quickly for profit, that's good.
That was Ernie Patricus, a former Federal Reserve official who's now a lawyer with White & Case. Patricus has seen that most rug merchants and banks don't just help buyers and sellers. Sometimes they just buy rugs for themselves to speculate that prices will rise. When banks do it, it's called proprietary trading, and it changes their interests.
The proprietary trader does what's good for the proprietary trader.
The Volcker Rule wants banks to be middlemen in the markets. They should be focused on their clients, not speculating on those rugs, or rather, stocks and bonds. But the banks, like the dude in the cult movie The Big Lebowski, will go to extreme lengths to keep their rugs.
That rug really tied the room together, did it not?
So banks are fighting the Volcker Rule. They say they're the only ones in the market willing to buy some of those rugs. European governments are helping the banks make their case. Matthew Cheplowich is an analyst with Colin Stewart.
What you've had is pushback from foreign finance ministers, central bank governors, and banking associations.
Why is that? Because European leaders need the banks to buy some of those risky government bonds that are looking a lot like unwanted rugs. In New York, I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
All right, forget Facebook, people. I got a whole new IPO for you. The owners of the Empire State Building filed papers to go public this week. We had Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith. Check it out.
The Empire State Realty Trust is hoping to raise $1 billion selling shares in the group of buildings that includes the Art Deco icon. And they might just get there, says David Menlo, president of IPOfinancial.com.
There's a lot of nostalgia that obviously is attached to the Empire State Building. It will command a premium.
You could call it the King Kong bump.
Kong is climbing the Empire State Building.
And you can't forget the ill-fated date Cary Grant makes with Deborah Carr in An Affair to Remember.
How about the top of the Empire State Building?
Oh, yes, that's perfect. It's the nearest thing to heaven we have in New York.
Right.
If heaven charged $20 at the door. And that's part of the point, says Max Wolf, senior analyst at Greencrest Capital. 10,000 people visit the Empire State Building every day, and most of the building's money doesn't even come from those ticket sales.
The Empire State Building has more office space than some downtowns of mid to small American cities.
Almost 3 million square feet. All told, the Empire State Building is bringing in about $17 million a month, partly thanks to its star power.
The marquee building, and it'll probably always be largely rented out because people desire that coveted address.
That coveted address also makes it a target. The owners mentioned terrorism nearly 50 times in the papers they filed to go public. Still, says Wolf, the Empire State Building is generating buzz among investors.
That is the anchor to get investors interested again, betting on the real estate.
And Wolf says the real estate market could really use some stardust right about now. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
John and Maggie Anderson live in Oak Park, Illinois. It's an upscale suburb just outside of Chicago. It's right up against the west side of the city, which is not upscale. The west side of Chicago is mostly poor. It's mostly black, too. And for a year, it was at the center of an experiment the Andersons ran on themselves. And on us, too, I guess. To find and shop only at black-owned businesses. They called it the Empowerment Experiment, and it's detailed in her new book, Our Black Year. It's good to have you both with us.
Hi there. Thank you for having us.
Hello, Kai. How are you?
Maggie, I want to start actually at the very beginning of the book, and I'm just going to read you your first sentence, and it's dated January 2nd, 2009, and you say, "The closer we got to Jay's Fresh Meats, the more my stomach hurt. It wasn't supposed to be like this." Tell us about that. This was your first real outing, right, to find a black-owned business?
For us, the real beginning may have been when we were conceiving of the experiment. We were thinking about how exciting it would be. And then that changed when we actually had to get in a car and go to the west side of Chicago. Folks like John and myself don't do that ever. We live in a pretty affluent suburb of Oak Park.
Even we should say black folks, right? I mean, it's, you know, you don't go there.
Oh, yeah. So we were literally just going through the phone book and looking for addresses on the west side of Chicago and calling. Hi, I'm Maggie Anderson. I'm trying to find a black-owned business. Are you black-owned? So we put Jay's Fresh Meats on our list. That's all we knew about Jay's Fresh Meats. It was basically a convenience store, and it was filthy. No one was in there shopping. It was tiny. The owner was not very welcoming. And then when she heard me talk, you know, she was like, yeah, she felt I was an Oak Parker, not another sister. And the whole point of my coming to her store was to show her that we are the same and that I want to support her.
Well, it was interesting because you confess in the book that you changed the way you spoke to her a little bit once you got into that environment.
If you have this conversation with more middle-class African-Americans, you're going to see that we do that all the time.
Well, this is the thing that's going to get us emails calling me a horrible person, but you don't sound black over the phone, right?
Well, we're using our phone and radio voice. Right?
Yeah.
No, this is how we talk to each other and right. Our friends.
Yeah, we used to call it lapsing into the dialect.
Yes. But when we want to make sure that we're connecting, we do lapse every once in a while.
Right. John, tell me the happy story. You go through many, many, many iterations of walking in, finding a very depressing black-owned business, and then finally you walk in to this place that is clean and well-stocked.
Absolutely.
And has good employees. Tell us about Farmers Best Market.
To set this up, it's kind of sad that we were so surprised that it fit the criteria. You know, Kareem Bia was the owner of the store. You know, he was a well-educated businessman who set up shop in a food desert area, which, you know, is a part of town that typically has residents that don't have access to fresh food, but it was fairly empty.
Mm-hmm. So this wasn't just don't be Jay's, be Kareem's, Farmer's Best. It wasn't just that. It's just that once we even have those top quality businesses with everything right, our own people won't make that extra step to just support them.
You actually say at a couple of points, and you've got the statistics to back it up, that just spending money in black-owned businesses isn't enough, right? And what are you supposed to do if just spending money is not enough?
Of course we want everybody to support the mom and pops. You should have a black dry cleaner. You should try to go to black restaurant twice a week. But we need the corporations to do a lot better with doing business with our businesses. That's the bigger part of the story. And think about the fact that in the top 500 privately held companies, none of those are black. It can't just be Oprah and Jay-Z. We can grow the South Coast papers of the world. That's where I get my paper. They're sold in Office Max. But if we can make South Coast Paper one of the biggest paper companies in the world and help them, they're now at 70 employees, why can't they be 500 employees? Think about what we can do just by buying paper.
Maggie Anderson, her book is called Our Black Year. Maggie and John, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Thanks for having us.
Coming up, yours truly goes soy, dairy, and gluten-free.
So get a little piping bag.
Piping bag.
Hold it, and when you're done piping just, around, yeah. Squeeze it.
Oh, man.
So you've done this before.
Also, gets told what to do in the kitchen. But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, not much love for Wall Street today. The Dow Industrials nudged up 4 points. That's a fraction of 1%, finished at 12,878. The Nasdaq put on less than a single point, ended flat, closed at 2931. But the S&P 500, well, it took down a point, a tenth percent, wrapped up at 1350. Bank of America withdrew around 3% today. Citigroup and Morgan Stanley each gave back about 2.5%. Retail sales were up 0.4% in January, as we said, but analysts expected twice that figure. The fashion world was all over the runway. Perry Ellis unraveled 3.5%. Gap bounced up 2.8%. Michael Kors looked sharp, up 27% on strong earnings. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-notes fell to 1.94%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at Marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at Marketplace.org/the Big Book.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. The Federal Reserve issues industrial production data for January. The National Association of Home Builders reports on builder confidence in the single-family housing market. And here's another look at housing. In New York City, the Museum of Modern Art opens an exhibit called Foreclosed: Rehousing the American Dream. Installations will feature new designs for cities and suburbs in the aftermath of the foreclosure crisis. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The lunch menu at the State Department today was roasted sweet potato soup and Alaskan butterfish, as President Obama welcomed China's next leader, Xi Jinping. Also served up were some thinly veiled economic warnings. The president encouraged the Chinese to follow the economic rules of the road as they grow, while Vice President Xi called on Washington to avoid protectionism. These are, you might say, touchy days in the Washington-Beijing economic relationship in all its forms. At least two high-profile trade fights are in the works. And we're not talking DVDs or fake iPhones here. Those are so today. Think industries of the future, clean energy in particular. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Scott Tong reports.
38-year-old Dijon Karabasevich was lonely. He got demoted from his wind power company, American Superconductor. His marriage was bad. Enter Sinovel, an opportunistic Chinese competitor. Sinovel offered Karabasevich a job, twice the salary and female companionship, in return for software secrets. That's American Superconductor's story, as it sues Sinovel, which denies the charges. Wind power and stolen secrets. It's part of the industry, says Raphael Coven of the research and advisory Clean Tech Group.
China is probably the most pronounced and unfortunately, the stage and the stakes are so high that it's extremely common.
U.S. officials have accused Chinese firms of systematically stealing American technology. And China's bad rap is hurting Sinovel, the world's second largest turbine maker. It's trying to go global, but Western countries are nervous to buy from an accused thief. Energy consultant Trevor Hauser is with the Rhodium Group.
If I'm a Chinese company and I'm only selling to the Chinese market, then there's not a huge amount of risk if I rip off an American firm. If I'm a Chinese company that has to sell on foreign markets, the cost of theft goes up considerably.
A separate case involves solar energy jobs. Solar World Industries America says Chinese competitors are selling solar panels illegally cheap. CEO Gordon Brinzer says that's why Solar World had to shut down a factory in Camarillo, California.
That factory goes back to the 1970s. Some of the pioneers in this industry got their start in that factory there in Camarillo, and unfortunately, it was a very difficult decision for us.
If Brinzer wins, the U.S. would put tariffs on Chinese solar panels. They would cost more.
There will be upward pressure on prices.
And there's the rub. If solar gets pricier, the whole industry could struggle to compete with other energy sources like natural gas. And the case could spawn copycat fights in places like Germany and India. And if China fights back, markets could close off, trade war. Penn Law professor Jacques Delisle says everyone is extra sensitive because this is big, bad China, and clean energy is supposed to be everyone's future.
Those are all things that will push that likelihood somewhat higher. If I had to bet, I think there will be some climb down, some compromise, some way out of it before we see a trade war.
Either way, most observers figure trade tensions are a long-term fixture of the relationship as Chinese firms move up the ladder and take on U.S. companies directly. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Chocolate is, of course, the easy go-to gift for Valentine's Day. But may I humbly suggest a donut instead? A refined, sugar-free, gluten-free, dairy-free, egg-free, soy-free, vegan kosher donut. I'm here to tell you such a thing does, in fact, exist. I know because I made some the other day. I did it with Erin McKenna. She's the co-founder of Baby Cakes. It's a chain of four bakeries so far that specializes in allergen-free baked goods. I went to see her at one of the two Baby Cake stores here in Los Angeles. And before we got started on those gluten, dairy, egg, soy-free, vegan, kosher donuts, though, I asked Erin to tell me exactly what gluten is.
Gluten is a protein found in wheat,
mm-hmm.
and it binds it. It gives it that chewiness.
And you have to replace that somehow,
yes.
right? Because people want that even if they can't tolerate the gluten.
Well, we start with rice flour.
All right. So rice flour, what else?
And arrowroot. And these give a little bit of chewiness.
Remind me what arrowroot is.
Arrowroot is it's just a root.
Of the arrow, if you
made
will.
Made of arrows.
There you go. All right.
Okay. And then we need salt.
Always.
To bring out the sweet.
Yep. Is this your recipe? You?
Yeah.
So was it a drive for a gluten-free vegan donut that made you start this business?
Yes.
I mean, really? Seriously?
Well, I mean, it was a drive for gluten-free vegan sweets in general.
Yeah.
Everything that was on the market was just honestly nasty, and I just started baking at home for myself.
This is 2005-ish, right?
Yeah,
2004,
it was
2005.
Four.
And what'd you do? Pull out your credit card and say, I'm going to start a bakery?
No, I got two jobs. The ingredients are expensive, so
yeah.
I had to work a lot in order to be constantly replenishing my pantry.
Wow.
So this is melted coconut oil.
This would replace butter, right?
Yes. So
we have the molds here.
These are the baking molds.
Okay.
We're just
going to
coat it a
yep.
little bit. And then finally,
it's like soy vanilla. Sauce, but I'm sure it's not.
Whoa,
is all that vanilla?
A lot of vanilla.
That's like a gallon of vanilla.
It's
no,
about
I'm
a
kidding.
Gallon
it's
of about, vanilla.
It's about a half a cup. But I mean, most recipes are like a quarter teaspoon.
You all know,
right, let me stir. Come on, let me get my hands dirty.
There you go.
All right,
there
is that
go.
Good?
Yes, that's perfect. Okay,
okay
that's
all right.
enough.
All right, well, you know, how'd you know there was the market for gluten, vegan, sweet stuff?
I was noticing more and more people picking up the gluten-free stuff. But I also saw not only that, but a transition from people eating just whatever to being more conscious about what they ate.
You have four shops now.
Yeah.
You went from nothing 6 years ago to four stores.
When I opened the first one, I didn't really think that I was going to open four. I just saw it as one little neighborhood shop that I really wanted to have for my own.
Yeah.
Over the years, people come from all over the world to our New York store, and they're constantly asking us to open here or there, whatever. Yeah, it just kind of happened organically. I was tugged to come to L.A.
That's great. All right, let's bake, and then we'll talk some more in a minute.
So you're going to pipe.
Wait, no. Really?
So this is the trick for piping.
Can't you just, like, pour it in? You can't pour it in there?
So get a little piping bag.
Piping bag.
Hold it, and when you're done piping around, squeeze it.
Oh, man.
So you've done this before, kind of. I can
tell. This is going to sound really stupid. It's amazingly labor-intensive. Right?
The donuts are very labor intensive.
Yeah, right?
The mixing,
right.
The piping. Actually, you don't have to do the hardest part, which is cleaning the pans.
Yeah, that's right.
It's the worst.
How did you know and when did you know that you weren't going to go broken, that you were actually going to be able to make this, whether it was one store or 20?
It was 7 months in the first store.
7 months?
Yeah.
That was break even.
That was break even.
Wow. What did you know about running a business before you did this? I mean, that's a horrible question, but
writing my business plan, I just got a book and it gave me the outline. I was like, okay,
wow,
so I write my business plan. My mother called it. She's like, okay, so you have no business experience. You have no money. You have no credit. Thinking back, I don't think I could ever get through those times,
yeah.
But I was young and really motivated and I just knew what was possible and I just did it.
It seems to me there's expansion possibilities into supermarkets, yes, and all kinds of different things.
Yeah. I actually just launched our cake mixes. And
oh, well, there you
mixes.
Go. See?
Yeah. So we're deciding where we're going to put them right now. And I'm thinking some of the gourmet grocery stores and, you know,
great.
Testing out the one by my house in New York and see how it does.
I'll be able to say I knew you when.
Yeah.
That'd be cool.
And then I'll ignore you. I'll act like I don't remember who you are.
Aaron, thanks a bunch.
Thank you.
All right, so two things. One is I really can cook. Come on, give me a break. Also, those donuts, not so bad. We've got a video of me in the kitchen. It's on our website, marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
A final note today on this Valentine's Day. As you know, love ain't cheap. A dozen roses, $75. Box of chocolates, $10 and way up. Or for something completely different, 83 cents. Gets you a White Castle burger. Unless you think I have no romance in me at all, which I think some of you probably do think, White Castle is doing Valentine's Day in style this year.
Tablecloths over on the tables. We'll have candles. We'll have flowers.
That's Mike Kaszubski. He's the manager of a White Castle in Chicago, and he is going to be a busy man.
Every single one of my tables is reserved for tonight, and I even actually extended my hours a little bit.
I actually don't know what to say about that, so I won't. That's Marketplace from APM on this Tuesday. Today, the Dow nudged up 4 points, a fraction of 1%, finished at 12,878. The NASDAQ put on about a half a point. We'll call that flat, 2931 the number. The S&P 500 ticked down 1 point, a 10%, closed at 1350. Robbie Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bradford Craig, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, and Brendan Willard engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. I hope you can join us again tomorrow. This is APM. That's American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.